This is Castle One. Race officer speaking.
Lay on head on boundary up ahead, 35 seconds out.
A bit lower and faster here. Lower and faster here.
Ho ho ho! That's a good one, Jimmy.
Still gaining on the lay line there. Gaining on the lay line.
We're looking at 10.5 to 42. Five. Matching him on the boundary, yeah. Copy.
Welcome back, podcast fans, and thanks again for joining us on another two-part edition of the podcast. And in this edition, we are talking to a man that has spent an entire career absolutely immersed in the world of the toughest trophy in world sport, the America's Cup. It's an enlightening listen. More of that shortly. First off, a big thanks to all of you that got in touch after listening to Alex Thompson. Many, many thanks. Your thoughts and your support mean a lot. It's great to know what you think of the podcast, so thank you. To those of you that took the time to head over to buy me a coffee, an extra special thanks. If you like what we do, please do head over to buymeacoffee.com/sailingpodcast. Leave us a message and buy us a coffee or two. I say it every month, but it does make a difference as we keep the podcast ad-free. It does take quite a lot of work to put together each month. So to all you coffee buyers, a big, big thank you. So I'm recently back from a trip to the wonderful city of Barcelona, home, of course, to the 37th America's Cup. It's a while away as yet, but there's plenty going on. Bases are being built. There's excitement in the air. I went over to spend some time with Swiss Cup team Alinghi Red Bull Racing. More of that in a coming podcast. But one of the main reasons for the trip was to sit down and chat with New Zealand Cup veteran Dean Barker. And when I say veteran, I'm not referring to his age. Dean has campaigned in a remarkable 6 America's Cups. Yes, you heard that right. He's a match racing world champion, he sailed an Olympics in Athens, and is one of the most experienced cup helms around. In fact, in the modern cup era, he's helmed more Challenger Series wins than any other Challenger skipper. As we'll hear, he's had to deal with some pretty famous losses in the cup itself. But Dean Barker is, without doubt, one of the most accomplished match racing helms of the 21st century. I hope you enjoy the time I spent with Dean Barker.
I think with match racing, it's just the instinctive decisions. But like, I suppose like a game of chess where you're looking sort of maybe 2 or 3 moves down the race course. I've had a number of pretty tough moments, I'd have to say, you know, in my career.
Dean Barker, making your debut on the podcast. We're so glad you're here. Thanks for coming on.
No problem. Nice to be here.
We're meeting rather randomly in Barcelona, home, of course, to the next America's Cup. Tell our listeners, Dean, what are you doing here in Barcelona? What are you up to?
Well, it's I guess it's sort of worked out well, but I'm here, a sailing consultant with Alinghi Red Bull Racing, and yeah, it's very much a part-time involvement, but so I come up here for a couple of weeks every 2 or 3 months, my role really is just to try and assist as best I can with the sailing team, sort of impart, I guess, a lot of my experiences, good and bad, on how it's been with the style of racing in these boats.
What's that been like? I mean, they're brand new to it, aren't they? All of them.
It's been something that's been actually really cool. I've enjoyed the involvement so far. I didn't really know any of the guys before, I knew Ivano, but really the other guys, I didn't really know them particularly well. Clearly we've had some very strong rivalry with Alinghi over the years, so and I've got to know Ernesto over time, but it's, to get to know the guys, the challenge of actually sort of being involved in a new team with pretty much zero sailing experience in this type of boat. It's it's obviously a long way to go, but at the same time very rewarding, if things go the right way.
Yeah, and they're a talented bunch, so that they're picking it up quickly.
Oh yeah, no, they are. There was a huge amount of talent. They're not strangers to foiling, which is a good start. But you know, as we know, it's the transition to this sort of type of sailing is quite a big step.
We've not seen Alinghi Red Bull Racing, as they're known now, since they lost that Deed of Gift match in 2010. It's great to have them back in the Cup arena. You know, how excited are the team to be back racing, but also challenging for the Cup in Europe?
I think it's actually very special. You know, when you look back at the history, the America's Cup is built really around the personalities that are involved, and whether it be sailing team or team principals, owners, you know, whatever it might be, it's always created some sort of like storyline. And Ernesto, you know, being the first person to to successfully challenge and win the America's Cup in the first attempt, and then defend it, you know, in the Valencia Cup in 2007, you know, that was obviously very impressive record. So having him back in the game, I think he's sort of probably been thinking about it for a long time, probably ever since the Deed of Gift match. Certainly having, you know, Alinghi Red Bull Racing now as a new challenger in this cycle is really good.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's certainly going to add a bit of spice. Dean, I've actually been, I don't know if you'll remember this, I've been in a race car with you. Mm. Round a race circuit in New Zealand. I mean, I know you're a man that likes to race cars. Do you think they'll let you have a go, do you think, the Red Bull guys? Is that on the cards?
Well, I'd have to say I was pretty happy when, you know, I saw that they were involved. Clearly they're very dominant in Formula One, and one of my real sort of, favourite pastimes is actually watching the V8 supercars, and predominantly it's in Australia, but they normally have a round in New Zealand also, and we've got a Kiwi driver that has won the last two seasons for the Red Bull team. So, yeah, I'm very passionate about it. So, yeah, if the opportunity presents itself, I'll definitely be pretty happy to go along to one of the events. But it's such a powerful brand, and you look at all of the different athletes, and you know, you kind of wonder where it's all going to fit together. But I'm sure, you know, there'll be some pretty cool activation along the way.
Let's quickly talk about Barcelona too. What are your thoughts? You're from Auckland, of course, born and bred, live there even now. What are your thoughts on a New Zealand team choosing to defend the Cup so very far from home?
Like, I think many other passionate Kiwis, it's a real disappointment or shame that the Cup is not in New Zealand. I think the Cup in 21 was fantastic, but it was a domestic America's Cup because of COVID. We were Fortress New Zealand. There was no one was allowed in. So New Zealand didn't really get the benefit of a proper, I guess, proper being, you know, sort of a hard to define word in this, you know, world. But, you know, we never saw all the super yachts that we'd seen previously, and just the atmosphere that it creates with all of these different, you know, international guests and people that come down to support the event. So while I can understand that there's commercial reasons for the event to be raced here in Barcelona, and look, the last time the event was in Europe, in Valencia, it was just, you know, it was pretty phenomenal what it did probably to grow the sport. But, you know, as a New Zealander, it's very, very hard to kind of sit there and go, oh yeah, I can understand, you know, that's the right thing, because I think we all would much prefer that it was being raced back home in Auckland and you know, the atmosphere it creates down there.
I think it's going to be quite good here, though. You've been hanging out here for a few trips. It's got a vibe, hasn't it?
It's a busy city. It's a happening place. You know, there's always things going on. The weekends, even though we're sort of really only in the start of spring, it's the weekends are chaotic already. And a couple of the trips last year, you know, sort of towards the end of summer, it's just incredible how busy the place is. And yeah, there's just a real atmosphere. It is a big city, big European city. Without question, it'll draw attention to the event. So I think, yeah, it, there's definitely worse places in the world to have an America's Cup. So I think it'll be a great spectacle.
Well, we've got plenty to talk about, Dean. But while I was scouting about online doing some research, I also saw that earlier this year you competed in the Laser Nationals back home in New Zealand.
Oh, my God.
I mean, can you still hike out? What was all that about, back to your roots, sailing dinghies? How was
well,
it?
Well, so I was volunteered to become Commodore of Murray's Bay Sailing Club. So that's my home club. I did all my sailing, junior sailing, right from day one there. Went through the ranks. It's a junior club, so you don't typically carry on as a senior member in too many things. But so the club was hosting the Laser Nationals in January this year. And so it was either go down and sort of be on the beach helping organise the event, or go and compete. So there was a little bit of pressure to get out there amongst it. And it was really, really cool. My practice was really going out to the start of the first race. I haven't sailed a laser since 1993, so 30 years ago. And I thought it was a great idea until probably waking up on the second morning when I could hardly move. But I really enjoyed it. It was quite refreshing. Race one didn't go so well, the OCS. So it put a bit of pressure on, but...
No software to help you cross the line.
No, and no one to blame either. But, it was just really refreshing. You know, you're sort of back to, you know, really grassroots sailing and really good fleet of boats. Really impressive just to see how the standard has just sort of kept moving on. You know, when I was racing lasers actively, you sort of thought, oh, yeah, well, it's pretty hard to see how the boats ever get sailed much better than that. But man, you know, the people that are in it these days are just, you know, next level, which is really cool. And the only thing that gave me a little bit of inspiration probably that I could still maybe manage it was the fact that Robert Scheidt's still busy at it. My very first, the two Youth Worlds I did, 1990 and 91, I raced against Robert. So, I've gone and done a bit of other stuff and he's still sailing lasers. So it's kind of been a bit of a bit of an interesting sort of cycle with that.
Well, they have a good master's circuit. You don't need to stop.
No, well, I am, after doing that, I am pretty keen to look at doing the next Masters Worlds, I think, are in Adelaide in Australia. So that's a pretty easy one to go and do, which would be great fun just to do it. But I think I'll try and do a little bit more training beforehand, if that's the case.
And hope Robert's not going.
Yeah, that's right.
As you say, Dean, you grew up in Murray's Bay in Takapuna, sailing from a pretty early age, I'm guessing. I mean, what are your memories of getting into the sport? How did all that happen?
Well, it was really just as simple as I had a choice, my parents gave me a choice between Sunday school or sport. And so decided that sailing was probably a good option. And so we went down to the local club, which happened to be Murray's Bay, and started off in the Optimist, which was, I was 10 years old at that stage. And at New Zealand, the progression was you'd learn how to sail in an Optimist and then you'd learn how to race in a P-class, which is a boat that is very much world famous in New Zealand. It's the only place you ever find one. But I hated it to start with. I really didn't enjoy it at all. Got stuck in Lake Pupoki one time and it just... But my dad sort of really stuck with it and sort of helped me through it a little bit in the early stages just to get the confidence, which is normally all it takes. It's, and then really from there, I started to really enjoy it. I came through on the back of a really, really strong generation of sailors out of the yacht club. Guys that I've sailed with and against for many, many years. And, Ray Davies, Hamish Pepper, Jeff Senior, who's, he's sort of, I think, one of the lead boat builders at Team New Zealand. There was just a huge group of very, very talented sailors. And so coming through on I suppose, on the tail of that, really helped to learn how to race better at a young age and sort of, you just drags the standard up and it was just one of those really great experiences, to have been involved in the club in those days.
It's a great place to sail. I have to say that Takapuna, it's amazing. I mean, there was also not just big influences at the club, Dean, but just think back, you know, as an 11-year-old, you'd have seen Russell Coutts win Olympic gold at the LA Games. It was a good games for the Kiwis generally. Another gold in the Tornado class with Timms and Sellers. And a little later, of course, Sir Peter Blake was winning the Whitbread on Steinlager too. I mean, some pretty good role models for a young, keen Dean Barker.
Yeah, well, interestingly, so Russell, you know, when he was, I'm not sure how old he was in the 84 Olympics, but Dad helped him out. So my father's company was a menswear company, and so he actually sponsored him a little bit, you know, gave him a bit of support in his 84 Olympic campaign. So when he returned from the games, he came around home with his medal and, you know, sort of got to see that and everything else. And it was really quite a incredible, you know, sort of experience. Russell also came and did a little bit of coaching at Murray's Bay Sailing Club. We used to have these live-in weekends over the winter, and he came and coached at a couple of those. And he was a bit of a hard taskmaster back then. He sort of, you know, I'd crossed paths with him, you know, pretty early on. So
it was all going on though in New Zealand, wasn't it? I mean, an incredible, as you say, generation of amazing sailors.
Yeah, well, I think also back in those days, so I think the 83 470 Worlds were in Milford or Takapuna at that stage, and Kiwis were 1, 2, 3. You know, you had obviously David Barnes and Hamish Wilcox. I think they won 3 World in a row. There was Peter Evans, there was Chris Dixon, Murray Jones. You know, there was so many incredibly talented sailors, and they were all sort of vying for that one spot to go to the Olympics. And, you know, as you say, you know, Rex Sellers and Chris Timms, you know, going out there just completely against all the odds and winning gold. Bruce Kendall, I think he was a bronze medalist there, and you know, that was sort of the Kendall tradition with the Olympic windsurfing. But yeah, it was a real golden period for the country. And yeah, again, as a young sort of sailor, you're just sort of obviously very influenced by all these different, you know, famous names and really successful sailors. And so, you know, definitely helps to sort of shape what you sort of do or how you look at the sport a little bit as you go through.
You competed in the laser initially, national champion in 1991, but you were also then really excelling at match racing. You know, how did all that develop?
I was really enjoying the laser, and so the pathway to that was because it was an opportunity to go and do the youth world. So doing a couple of those, that was in the laser representing the country, that was a pretty amazing experience. Continued on with the laser, and at the same time, I think it was 93 really, where I first, you know, Russell asked if I would, you know, come and do a bit of part-time sailing with the team. Yeah, you know, they were preparing for San Diego in the early stages, and so got involved with that, and there was a bunch of different regattas and things that were going on, and that was my first real taste of match racing. Never obviously watched a lot of it, you know, all the sort of the legends of the match racing sort of arena, you know, the Chris Dixon, Russell, you know, used to have Harold Cubmore, and, you know, like, it was just all sorts of guys, Eddie Watanoa, you know, that all come down to New Zealand. There was it was called the Citizen Match Cup or something at that stage, and yeah, we always used to watch that, and it was always pretty interesting. But it wasn't really till 93 when you sort of start to get a bit of a taste for the match racing that, you know, you really sort of thought this is something that I'd like to sort of continue a bit further. And I think it was probably 96 or 97 where I sort of started doing the match racing sort of on my own bat, which was, yeah, quite a change from where I'd been, but also just something that I really, you know, I guess clicked with and really enjoyed.
As you say, you know, with hindsight, obviously it's an area that you'd excel in, eventually becoming match race world champion. In your mind, Dean, what makes a good sailor a winning match racing sailor?
It's very different to a lot of forms of sailing. Like, you don't necessarily have to be good at making a boat go fast, because typically all the equipment you have is supplied. And so there's certain techniques and things you learn with the different boats you used to go and race on the circuit, and some boats would suit some people more than others, and you'd sort of got a feel for who was good, and then you look at what they were doing. But I think with match racing, it's just the instinctive decisions. You need to be able to, you know, not rely on other people on the team to make those decisions. You know, you're taking input on time on distance, lay lines, you know, boat intersections and everything else around the course. But what you need to be able to do is look at any situation and be able to play it forward and sort of, but like, I suppose like a game of chess where you're looking sort of maybe two or three moves down the race course. But also around the start line, you know, every decision, you can't sort of be waiting for someone to tell you what to do. You know, you need to be able to sit there, analyse the situation, and then make the call, right or wrong. And if you get it wrong, then try and figure out a way to make it right.
I always remember speaking to Ian Williams, who's been match race world champion a ton of times, hasn't he? And he saw it as a formula. It was almost mathematics. And it's a very different way. It's a very different mindset to the normal course racing that we're all used to.
Absolutely. It's very analytical, because there's probably a lot of set moves or counter moves that you need to sort of, you know, figure out. And they don't all apply necessarily with the different boats, you know, whether they're manoeuvrable or really, you know, hard to manoeuvre. And the thing, you know, I was, again, very, very fortunate, because when I started to match race, I was part of Team New Zealand. And so I started off just sort of in an afterguard role, but then we started doing some match racing, sailing with a few of the guys out of the team. And so we started doing quite a lot of match racing against Russell. So you look at it and go, well, you know, at that time, I think he'd won the Brute Cup or whatever, and he was the match racing world champion or, you know, number one. So it's pretty hard to get a better teacher, or someone to learn from. And so that quickly developed the skills. You know, you just get a natural sort of head start. And then really from there, you start to learn, you know, these are the key things to work on. And yeah, and so that, you know, by doing a few events and doing well, then got the opportunity to start steering the backup boat in New Zealand.
We're going to get to that in just a second. But just take you back to the dinghies. I mean, you had your heart set on an Olympic appearance, trialling for Atlanta. I mean, that's right, isn't it, in 1996. But I've read that you turned down a place in the Cup team at that time in favour of your Olympic hopes.
Yeah, so after the 93 Laser Worlds, I decided that I was going to jump in the fin. I felt there was enough time to learn the ropes in the boat. I had to obviously put on a decent amount of weight. The challenge was that Craig Monk was the bronze medalist in the 92 Olympics here in Barcelona. I sort of took it on, you know, tried to learn the boat and do everything else. And, you know, things were going really, really well. You know, I was sort of making some good progress. You know, Craig was, you know, very well known as being a very good, strong weather fin sailor. And so that was always going to be the challenge. And so, just worked hard on that. In those days, the Olympic selection was just a first across the line, New Zealand only fleet raced in New Zealand. And so our trials, it started off about as well as it could have. And so I think it was a 10 race series or 12 race, I don't remember exactly now, but with two races to go, I needed to have a fourth, even if he won both races and won those two races. And then, yeah, the second to last race, you know, it was just a shocker. And then the last race, it was really, really tight, but tried to match race him, didn't quite work out, and, you know, and then the rest history. So we finished tied on points, but he won the count back. And it would probably be one of the, you know, I've had a number of pretty tough moments, I'd have to say, you know, in my career. Yeah, it's not all roses, like I'm sure a lot of the other people that you've interviewed on your podcast. But yeah, that the 96 trials was a really, really bitter pill to swallow. Because you sort of, you put everything into it and you don't think about, you know, the next thing. So it's, and so when it doesn't work out quite the way you're hoping, and, you know, I certainly didn't go in there as the favourite, but had a really strong belief that I could win and did actually have the opportunity to do that. And then when you don't, it all does feel like the world comes crashing down. So, yeah, it was a while before, you know, I really felt a desire after that to, you know, to really sort of get back into the sailing. And really the first opportunity that came along was to do some coaching work with Hamish with the laser for the 96 games. And then also Russell asked if I'd go and fill in for Warwick Fleury, actually, at the time, I think, in the Match Racing Regatta in Sweden, in Marstrand. So that was really the sort of the step back into, you know, getting sort of excited about sailing again. In New Zealand, we're a country surrounded by water, and Auckland's the city of sails. You know, there is an affiliation with sailing in the sea. Yeah, the ranks of Team New Zealand in 2000 was just decimated. I'd say it would have been very uncomfortable for a lot of the guys that had left and gone to the other teams.
Let's talk a bit more about the Cup, though, because 1995 in San Diego, and Russell Coates is the skipper of Team New Zealand, leading the team to victory, a 5-0 win over the Americans. And there you are as an upcoming talent. I mean, how exciting was that moment for you?
It was phenomenal. I was in Europe at the time, so it was really hard to actually be able to sit there and watch it. So I was really gutting, you know. You know that they're over there, they're on fire with the way it was all going and just winning all the Challenger races. And then when you sort of heard the news that they were starting to win races in the Cup match itself, you're thinking, wow, this is pretty cool. But this is all pre-cell phones and internet and everything else. So, like, trying to, you know, I'm ringing collect calls home trying to find out what's going on. So it was, yeah, like, I wasn't in New Zealand for all the celebrations or anything like that. So obviously we saw all the pictures and the ticker tape parades. And, yeah, I think it's amazing. New Zealand is it's a country that's so focused on sports and sports teams and just that connection that it creates. And, and it's good and bad. But, yeah, when you see the reaction of the New Zealand public, you know, when they were successful, because you go back to 87 when the America's Cup, sorry, 83 when the America's Cup actually became an event, when after 132 years, Australia go on and win it. And in New Zealand, you know, we all sort of knew about it. 87 was the first time New Zealand challenged for the America's Cup, and that's where it really came alive. And so that, you know, the several challenges, you know, or two main challenges which were unsuccessful, but then that provided the, I guess, the backbone of the 95 team to be able to go on and ultimately be successful. And just, you know, what it did for the country was just, you know, beyond belief. You know, the vision that Sir Peter had, you know, for what it could do to the, just particularly the Auckland waterfront was just, you know, next level.
With the prospects of a home defence then, how determined were you to be part of the 2000 Cup?
I think after doing the Match Racing Regatta with Russell and his guys, I enjoyed everything about it. Like, the match racing was fantastic. We got through to the final. I think it was against Bertrand, actually, and just really exciting to really enjoy the sailing again, do something a bit different. And so the thought of actually being involved was something that I really wanted to have the opportunity to do. And, you know, when Russell rang and said, you know, eventually, you know, would you like to be involved? Well, it didn't take a lot of time to say yes. So, and really to be involved in that group of people was, you know, like, really shaped you know, the start of my keelboating career.
I'm guessing with Russell running the show, there was no chance at helming throughout the defence. So in the build-up, what was your role, Dean?
Well, when I joined the team, it was to be part of the afterguard. Really the early days, you know, Russell and Murray were the two helmsmen. But when we started doing some match racing and doing well, pretty quickly got the opportunity to start steering the second boat. And with Murray ending up sort of going to be on the race boat anyway, it sort of was sort of worked out really well. So I sort of got 2 or 3 years of the opportunity to steer the backup boat and all the testing and training and then all the in-house racing that we did. And so, again, just learning how to manage a 75-foot boat in a match racing environment. You know, you're obviously pretty nervous about doing anything silly, but you know, when you're sitting there with a crew of 17 people, it's quite a different type of sailing to when you're sailing around with 4 or 5 in the match racing circuit. So just that progression and getting that experience again was just, you know, I was very fortunate to be in that position.
What was it like in the team then? I guess, you know, what kind of culture was there and how was it every day going out trying to beat Russell Coutts?
I really enjoyed the challenge. You know, the thing that I look at is just the people that Russell had surrounded himself with within the sailing group, particularly. You know, there's Brad, obviously, you know, Warwick, Simon, Robbie Naismith, you know, Tony Ray, Jeremy Scannery, Barry Mackay, you know, the list goes on, the Dodsons, you know, it was kind of the who's who of New Zealand sailing. And going back to 87, when I was sitting there as a young kid watching the first challenge there, all these guys that I was now sailing with were the people that were there at the very first time. And it was just like, you know, it was kind of a bit surreal to begin with, but then you realise very quickly that, you know, they're just, you know, good Kiwi guys. You know, they're just, you know, passionate and just a very infectious sort of, just determination to be able to defend the cup in New Zealand. And it was really quite incredible just how hardworking and how much effort went into making sure that 2000 was a successful event and a great defence.
The Italians, Luna Rossa, won the Challenger Series, of course, and then through to the Cup matches where Coutts and co. won the first 4 races. One more win and the Cup was successfully defended. What happened next?
Well, I'd been out on the chase boat watching all the races, and I've never been so nervous watching a race ever, because, you know, here they come off the line in the start of the first race, and you don't know whether or not you're going to be fast enough. You know, are they going to be really fast? You know, we knew they were going well because they'd sort of come through a very hard fought Challenger Series, and obviously by the time we'd won the fourth race, even though it felt, yeah, you pretty much knew that ultimately the team would be successful. It wasn't like you just jump on the boat and it would be off. And so after the fourth race, that night, Russell said, "Oh, look, you know, would you be keen to jump on and do the last one?" And of course, you know, I'm young and probably don't even think about what the consequences would be, but it was like, absolutely, you know, just it just wasn't any hesitation whatsoever. It was all just a real blur really from there. You know, waking up the next day, getting out on the water, you know, we were going out to the start. One of the shore crew had passed away during the campaign, and we scattered his ashes on the way out to the start that day and got out there and just went through the normal routine. And because I'd been involved, obviously, on the other side, been on the second boat, and we'd do the lineups to sort of check in how everything was going. And then, next thing, you know, we're into the start sequence. And the thing which was I think made it a lot easier to kind of manage in a way was just the fact that you're slotting into a just such a well-oiled machine. You know, Brad was there, you know, as the steadying influence, and you just knew that the guys that were there were just going to perform at a level that you know, it was just that little bit better. And so, yeah, it was actually, you know, quite an incredible experience to slot into that and to have that experience.
Were you not nervous? I mean, helming in your first cup match at home in front of thousands and thousands of home fans.
Yeah, but I think because it had the benefit of doing so many races against Russell and you know, effectively the race crew over the months leading up to it, I think just sort of, you sort of had a confidence or a belief that you'd be able to, you know, step on there and do a good job. And, you know, fortunately the start worked out well and we sort of got off well and sort of stretched out to a comfortable lead and that made it really, you know, probably a lot easier to manage. You know, you sit there afterwards going, well, if the start hadn't been quite so good or we were behind or, you know, would we have got past, you know, then, you know, you sort of all the ifs and buts. But yeah, it was, I'm sure like I would have been incredibly nervous, but again, with the people that you sort of were looking around the boat going, you know, we've got the best team out here by a stretch. So it was, the confidence that you gained from that has, you know, definitely made the job a lot easier.
What was that like I've seen the footage, but, you know, describe it for me when you crossed the line in New Zealand, having defended the cup and what happened after you'd won it? What was that like?
It was quite incredible. You know, it's something that I'll never, ever forget. Just having having the chance to be part of it was, you know, it was pretty special in the first place, but then to be on the right, on the boat when we crossed the finish line, you know, obviously you're just one of however many we had in the team at that stage. But yeah, it was just like just a huge weight off the shoulders, I'm sure, for everyone within the group, just to have been successful and to defend it at home. And then, you know, you sort of tow back in and there's just, you know, thousands of boats everywhere and you're back into the viaduct and there's just, you know, just people, just wall to wall. And it was just like incredible. And then to actually, that was the first time I'd ever touched the cup. And yeah, and that was probably the start of a pursuit of, you know, trying to be able to do that again. And it's, it was just a huge amount of relief. And you know, you sort of, I remember thinking at the time, you know, how does it ever get any better? You know, there's got this fantastic group of people and, you know, if this all stays together, then it's going to, it's going to be pretty hard to beat.
The immediate aftermath of that win in Auckland, how did that change the young Dean Barker's life?
I suppose, again, because New Zealand is so passionate about sports, the media does focus on sporting events and personalities within the thing. And because I'd been steering the boat and there was a story around that and everything else, so, you know, suddenly you are sort of thrust into the spotlight. And yeah, as much as you think you can probably deal with it, it does change your life quite a lot, you know, just the way you go to the supermarket or something else and people, you know, they've been watching and they recognise you and things, and it's something that you probably never ever get comfortable with. But what is cool is the fact that people are so passionate about the sport, be it rugby, cricket, sailing, netball, you know, whatever it might be. And it's it does you know, make you sort of, I know, probably, you know, feel a lot better about all the hard times as well as the good. You know, everyone sees the end, the champagne and everything else, but they don't necessarily see all the hard work that goes into to get to that point. But it's so that definitely changed when you end up with a lot more focus sort of around, you know, just your personal life, which yeah, again, I'm not, I don't, I certainly don't enjoy that part of it.
Let's just touch on the sailing thing in New Zealand, Dean. I mean, explain to our listeners just how big sailing is and the cup in particular at home. And why do you think that is? I mean, as you say, there's a massive amount of not just passion, but knowledge in the Kiwi community.
Yeah, well, there's no question. You know, you know, after the San Francisco Cup or before, you know, I remember them, you know, being in a taxi and the taxi driver telling me about foiling jibes, you know, and you just sort of think, well, you know, when is that ever sort of a thing? You know, people just don't know about sailing, you know, really. But in New Zealand, we're a country surrounded by water, and Auckland's a city of sails. You know, there is an affiliation with sailing in the sea. And while people don't necessarily understand yacht racing particularly well, you know, we know it's not an easy sport to televise back in the good old days. But obviously, things continue to evolve. It's sort of becoming easier to understand for the non-sailing minded. But it's still it is a difficult proposition. But yeah, in New Zealand, for whatever reason, I think it's just maybe it's the small country against, you know, the might of some of the other countries, or whatever the storyline. It's always been you know, incredibly well supported. You know, the passion, you know, with the wins and also the with the losses, it's it does, you know, make you realise that people, you know, do care a lot.
So 2000, it was a landmark win, but very quickly, in a very well-known story, Coutts and Brad Butterworth, both so pivotal in winning and then defending the cup, left for new Swiss team Alinghi. A massive story back home. What are your memories of that, and how did you first find out what was going down?
It was you know, difficult at the time because, you know, we'd been, you know, been successful, you know, enjoyed the parties and things afterwards, and, you know, it was probably a little bit in that hangover period where, you know, we're sitting there and there were these rumours starting to sort of pop up about, you know, some of the team members sort of getting itchy feet and being approached by the teams and what have you. So yeah, I remember trying to get hold of Russell and Brad, and they were away at the time and things, and just sort of, you know, like, you know, because I was quite concerned that there was a chance that we might lose some of the key people. And it was sort of felt like there was nothing really happening. It wasn't sort of progressing. You know, Peter was, he was out. He wasn't going to do another cup after 2000. So it was like, wow, you know, where's this all going? You know, Russell and Brad were, you know, they were the new guys in charge, and they were going to run the team, and, you know, it was going to sort of take a different direction, and all these, you know, all the people that were there were going to sort of continue on. And it all felt, you know, amazing, but then it was sort of like, well, you know, where's all the momentum? You know, we sort of need to make sure we lock everyone in, and how's it all going to sort of go from here? And it just, there was just silence and nothing really happened. And then obviously at some point, I don't remember how long after, but it became clear that they were going to go and start the new team with, as you say, Alinghi with Ernesto, and they were taking a few guys with them. And then with the success of the Cup in New Zealand in 2000, you know, we had all of the super yachts basically filling the viaduct, and, you know, there was a lot of, you know, very wealthy individuals that were there on their boats, and clearly they took a liking to what they saw and the event and everything else. And so next thing we had, you know, Larry Ellison with Oracle sort of deciding to go ahead, and then also the McCaw brothers, I think it was, with the with One World. And the obvious way to get going was to try and pick up as many of the top sailors and designers as they could to like as a starting point. And so, yeah, the ranks of Team New Zealand in 2000 was just decimated. Like, it was just, you know, I can't even remember what it was off the race boat of how many went, but it, you know, it was pretty much everyone. And a good chunk of the design group, and it was like, wow, you know, this has kind of gone from feeling one of the most amazing sort of things to one of the scariest, because, you know, like, here we were with a very young and experienced sailing team that was left, and you know, parts of a very successful design team. Yeah, sort of figuring out how on earth we were sort of going to pull it all together and get going again.
How did the team react? What happened?
Well, Tom Snack, who was obviously a fundamental part of the team in 1995 and in 2000, he, you know, he was more than, you know, happy to step up to the plate. And Ross Blackman also joined the team, and he'd been involved previously in, I think, 95 and, you know, before that also. And so the two of them really sort of took on, you know, Ross the commercial side, Tom the design team, and I was sort of there to help put this, or to put the sailing team together and get up and running again. And so, you know, we had obviously fantastic assets as a starting point, and yeah, and that was sort of really how the 2003 campaign got underway. But it was definitely not how I envisaged, you know, it was going to look like. So yeah, it was quite daunting, because, you know, the plan would be that I was going to steer the boat, but obviously with Russell and Brad, you know, running the team.
There is an argument, of course, that Russell leaving the team was a big opportunity for One Dean Barker. Did it feel that way to you?
At the time, I think I sort of probably very naively thought, well, you know, we've won it in 2000. We can, you know, as a young group of sailors, we can put it together, and, you know, there's no reason why we can't be successful again. And, you know, the one thing that I probably learnt more out of anything in that campaign was just that, you know, grey hair is worth a lot. And, you know, what we had in enthusiasm, we lacked massively in experience and the ability to probably drive. You know, one of the strengths of the 95 and 2000 campaign was that Russell and a lot of those guys were able to drive the design group to, you know, as we will talk about, as a sailor-driven campaign. Whereas 2003, we just didn't have that depth of knowledge or the experience within a design group to be able to say, this is what we need or this is what we want. And ultimately, you know, we made a lot of good decisions, but we also probably made, you know, some pretty fundamental mistakes as well, which, you know, had we had the experience there, would we have made them? Well, it's hard to say, but at the time, you know, we could only trust, I suppose, in the direction that that we were going.
We've talked about the national pride in the team, the love of Team New Zealand. I mean, how much pressure did you then feel as the skipper for the 2003 defence?
A huge amount of responsibility, because, you know, you didn't want to be the person that was involved in losing the cup after winning it and defending it. You know, you didn't want to be sitting there going, well, now we've lost it. But yeah, like the pressure was immense, you know, as we got closer and closer to it, watching the Challenger series going on, not being a part of that is really, you know, it's really quite difficult. And yeah, you look across the fence, you know, we had Alinghi as our neighbour, and you're obviously pretty impressed with the way that they were coming through. And, you know, again, knowing that the people that were in there would be doing a very good job, yeah, it was quite a daunting thing. And so when they ultimately won the Louis Vuitton trophy and became the challenger for the America's Cup, you know, I was certainly under no illusion that it was going to be a very difficult prospect to race them. But it wasn't that we were, you know, scared of racing them, because I'd raced those guys, you know, many times in the previous campaign. But now we're at sort of, you're playing for keeps, and you know, we'd raced against them at two or three different occasions on the match racing circuit, and you know, we'd had good success with that. But yeah, it's obviously a different story when you're at home, you know, racing to keep the America's Cup in New Zealand.
What was it like? I mean, give us a sense of the atmosphere. What was that atmosphere like in Auckland at that time?
Well, as you can imagine, with the New Zealand public not being particularly supportive of the decisions that the guys that had taken, there was a lot of, I guess, I'd say it would have been very uncomfortable for a lot of the guys that had left and gone to the other teams. And so there was, it probably almost made it sort of a more dramatic kind of event, because, you know, there were people there that just, yeah, would have hated to see Alinghi doing well, because, you know, the association, you know, they were seen as, I don't want to say traitors, because it's not the, you know, but there were a lot of people that were probably pretty upset with the decisions that a lot of those guys had made, and yeah, wanted to see Team New Zealand probably more so than ever be successful.
The scoreline, of course, tells the story of the result, but it doesn't tell the whole story. Your boat withdrew from racing, taking on water in race one. You then lost two very close races. Then race four, 3-0 down. Tell us what happened then.
Yeah, well, it had been a terrible way to kick off the regatta. You know, the race one, the boat, you know, just, we were racing in strong winds, and yeah, we had all sorts of issues. You know, it just shouldn't have happened. Race two or three, I can't remember which one it was. You know, we had the lead until the final leg and lost. You know, they passed us pretty much a few hundred metres before the finish line, and that was just like heartbreaking, because, you know, it just felt like there was a chance to sort of just turn the momentum around. And then race four, yeah, we went off the start line and it was quite choppy and things, but it was just a nice sailing breeze off the East Coast Bays, and yeah, we're sailing along, the mast fell over the side, and yeah, we hadn't had a failure like that in all the campaign and all the sailing, and you just think, why, you know, why does it happen today out of all of the days that it could have happened? Why couldn't it happen 2 months ago? But it happened, and you know, there we were, sort of, you know, just incomplete, you know. Yeah, it was just brutal. You know, you just really the hopes of the team just came crashing down with the mast in that particular race, because, you know, we weren't going to come back against a very well-oiled and very strong team, you know, from 4-0 down.
The end result, of course, New Zealand lost that cup 5-0. What was the reaction at home to that defeat?
As much as you sit there with all of the enjoyment when you're successful, you know, the flip side of that is when things don't go well, it's incredibly challenging. You know, it has become very personal, and it becomes very difficult for a lot of people. You know, in the end, it's the job you sign up for. You know, when you take on the role that I had within that team, you know, ultimately you are responsible for the result. And yeah, it certainly doesn't make it any easier. But you know, I was incredibly proud of the effort that the team had put in. You know, clearly the result was far from, you know, what any of us had ever hoped for or envisaged, and yeah, certainly wasn't acceptable in any shape or form. But yeah, like the aftermath is just, yeah, it's just really, really challenging, you know, for friends, family, you know, personally, you know, you just feel like you've let so many people down. You know, the fact that you've lost the cup, it's gone offshore, and whether, you know, New Zealand will even be part of it again in the future was just like, yeah, very difficult to stomach. But yeah, some dark days again, but it was you sort of knew you knew the risk going into it, and we did the best that we thought we could do, you know, given the circumstances that we're in.
A tough time personally, Dean, but all the while, of course, the Olympics were still beckoning. You still were thinking about it. And in 2004, a year later, after all of that, you finally went to the Games in Athens in the Finn class. What did it mean to you? How refreshing was it to go and do that and to represent New Zealand at the Olympic Games?
It was one of the coolest things I've done, and also one of the most frustrating, because, you know, it just didn't, you know, I'd raced the Finn in the 96 trials and hadn't raced it again. So it was a very compressed program. You know, I was sort of fortunate to team up with Ben Ainslie and his sort of training group with his coach Sid, and you know, and I thought that, mistakenly thought that I'd be able to, you know, very quickly sort of get up to speed and everything else. And you know, I had some reasonable results. I think I was fourth in the Europeans, you know, not that long before the and this was, you know, basically I had a 6 month campaign from jumping in the boat to racing in Athens. And I thought that, you know, that it'd be able to translate into a good result. Like I knew there was no chance of actually going out there and beating Ben, or, you know, given, you know, his history in the class and everything else, but wanted to be able to equip myself well enough to go and do well. So to achieve the goal of getting to the Olympics was really special. I think in Olympics in Athens, as you well know, it's you know, it was a great place to go and do an event like that. But when you get there, you actually want to probably do yourself justice, and I was hoping to, you know, to try and sneak into the top five and you know, even slightly better, but just, you know, I was just wasn't good enough to be able to achieve that with the time I'd had in the boat.
That's it for part one, as we leave Dean between cup campaigns post the 2004 Athens Olympics. Coming up in part two, we continue on Dean's relationship with the cup, which of course also means a discussion about the 2013 Cup in San Francisco. I'm going to thank Dean at this point for agreeing to sit down and chat, but also for his honesty and his integrity. It's not easy talking about some of the things we discuss in part two, but Dean didn't falter. It would be indiscreet of me to give away Dean's age, but he took off back to Auckland after our interview to celebrate a landmark occasion. So I'd also, well, I'd like to wish him congratulations and a very happy birthday. We recorded the podcast at the fantastic Real Club Nautico in Barcelona. To the club, a big thank you for your hospitality. And also a big thanks to the team at Alinghi Red Bull Racing, Sophia and her team in the comms department, and many, many thanks for making it all work. Again, if you like what we're doing and you're loving your monthly fix of sailing chat, do head over to buymeacoffee.com/sailingpodcast and support the work we do on the podcast. It means a lot and helps us put the whole thing together ad-free every month. Before I go, the usual heartfelt thanks to the very talented Tim at Vertigo Films for producing the podcasts with an attention to detail worthy of any America's Cup design team. Tim, many, many thanks. And so that's us. Do tune in to part two with Dean. And until next time, thank you so much for listening. Have fun on the water and sail safe, everyone.
This is Castle One. Race officer speaking.
Boundary up ahead, 35 seconds out.
Get
lower and faster here.
Lower and faster here. Ho, ho, ho. That's a good one, Jimmy.
Still gaining on the line, aren't they?
Looking at 10-5, 42. Matching
him on the boundary, yeah.
Copy. This is Castle One standing by. Out.